Hi, and welcome to this week's Outlander, official Outlander podcast. I am Tony Graffia, writer and executive producer. I'm here this week with staff writer Danny Barrow, who wrote this terrific, terrific episode, 607, Sticks and Stones. Welcome, Danny.
Thank you, Tony. I'm really excited to be here with you and watching the episode today.
Yeah, we haven't seen this one in a while, even though it aired this week. Let's jump right in because this is what we called a cold open, which is a scene before the main titles. And tell us a little about this scene, which we called Malva's Confession, and how it was later in the script, wasn't it, when you first wrote it? And then later we decided to put it as a cold open.
Yeah, so initially this scene, it used to take place as a sort of little flash while Roger was giving his sermon, but I think we decided that it was so, you know, sort of powerful to have that kind of presence of Malva being alive at the very beginning, you know, before you see her in her, you know, tragic state. And I think that was really an interesting decision, you know.
Yeah, I think it works great there because you've just seen Malva. The last scene of the last episode was Malva, you know, dead in a horrific way. And to open with this gives you a little insight into her and where her mind was at. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, I think we had them. She said, I think in the last episode, I should know this because I wrote that one and I totally they all blur together for me, but I believe she says to Claire, he made me stand up and tell the whole congregation. So this wasn't a scene from the book, but when you saw that in my script, you were like, let's see that scene. And I thought that was a great decision to go, what was that scene like that when her father made her tell the whole congregation?
Yeah. And it's chilling. You know, a terrifying thing to have to do. And, you know, I was really eager to make sure that, you know, without giving anything away, that she is telling what is the truth to her. So it's her truth. So even though we may not know, you know, who she's referring to, you know, she's telling the truth. So
And this shot, I remember you put it in the script. And I remember it's one of those things that kind of made me gasp a little when I read the scripts from the other writers. I'm always like, I'm seldom surprised because a lot of it, obviously, you know, you're used to working on Outlander all this time, but when I saw the description of the ladybug, I just thought that was such a beautiful touch because it was just such a delicate thing and a ladybug, you know, and the beauty of it and the, you know, juxtaposed with the awfulness of this death. I just thought that was a visual that I'm not great at thinking of that. I'm not a visual person. I have trouble with the visuals. I'm much more focused on the dialogue and the words. So I always, when another writer can do something that is the ubiquitous show, not tell, I think it's awesome. And so I always loved that ladybug. And miraculously, we did get a ladybug and actually filmed this.
A trained ladybug.
Yeah, a trained ladybug. We auditioned some ladybugs. No, because sometimes it's a special effect, but this was not. This was an actual ladybug. So
yeah, no, well, thank you. And I think, you know, I think that I find personally that sometimes I do kind of zoom in into the micro details, and that kind of helps me then build up a bigger image in my mind of what we're trying to portray. I love this scene. I really enjoyed writing this scene, and it was, you know, one where, you know, I have so much admiration for Katrina, who's pregnant, obviously at this time, and having to work on this. And at the time, I was also pregnant while working on this, so I think we were both kind of channeling that energy. And you know, when Claire says those words about the baby being so full of light and life,
it's heartbreaking.
That was something that, you know, I felt was, you know, very emotional, and something that I definitely wanted to include, that little nod to the book there about the, you know, the light, the blue light, which we don't include here, but
I talked about that in the death scene from last week, the blue light on the baby from, you know, from the book mentioned. And but some of the other stuff here, I loved line where Tom Christie is like, did she die quick? And you think that he cares about her and he wants to make sure she didn't suffer, but he's really just worried, did she have time to pray for forgiveness so that her soul is saved? And to have him say she can't be buried in the consecrated ground at the church is just You know, yeah. I mean, it just, he lost his daughter, but again, he's such a man, so steeped in his head, in the, the righteousness. He just doesn't, he's a very complicated character, and he,
It's definitely his lens, I think, for understanding the world. I think he's a man who needs everything to be sort of very black and white. And I think it, for him, that sort of involves knowing that there's a heaven and there's a hell. And, you know, that's where you go. And, you know, you want to get into one and not the other, obviously. And I think that helps him process the world. But he's starting to see, I think, that there are more shades of gray than perhaps he would care to admit.
Yeah.
So
and I think Claire, this is obviously the beginnings of her doubt of what happened. You know, did she, she obviously last week had this, was it a dream? Was Malva really there? Is there some culpability here? Did she black out and do something horrific? And we're meant to have a little doubt here. I mean, Claire is meant to have doubt about herself. And that's part of the drama of this episode is, you know, how this lands on the characters is the important thing. I know we talked a lot about the detective story of it all, like the whodunit and should Jamie and Ian go out and, you know, search the ridge and try to find clues and where's the evidence. And that's just not what we do, though. We're not a plot driven show. It's about the emotion and how this lands on these characters and what it makes them feel. And here's, coming up is this shot that, is this shot in the main titles when Jamie's carrying Malva Chris? I believe that
the hand, I think her, Malva's hand is in the titles. And
yeah, we picked and choose so many main title shots, went back and forth. And I couldn't remember if this one actually landed in the final main title, but it did. And people were trying to guess what it was. And here it is. I always like to point out when we get around to one of the main title shots that there it was, that Jamie was carrying that hand belonged to a dead Malva, which probably a lot of people wondered what the heck that was.
Yeah. And I, you know, I love that the phrases are kind of so considerate about Malva, even in death. And I think for me, this was something when I tried to picture this, when I was, you know, writing the scenes, you know, how horrifically tragic and mentally just grueling it would be to have to kind of use the skill that you use to save lives here to kind of take care of her body and leave it in a state, you know, in which she can be buried in a dignified way and to try and care for her even in death.
Yeah.
And so obviously we've got these shots of her kind of her hand shaking, trembling a little bit as she's trying to kind of prepare to sew up the wound.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's amazing and wonderful of Claire actually to, even in her traumatized state, she wants to, you know, like you said, do justice to Malva. And
and I think these little shots here of the bird and everything as well, you know, she's also trying to hold on to that light that she felt in Malva. She's trying to hold on to the good, but it's being kind of overridden in a way by this this self-doubt that you mentioned earlier, Tony, that, you know, with Lionel coming in here and really sort of speaking her thoughts.
We've been slowly introducing the specter of Lionel through several episodes. And at first, I mean, we planned this out in the writer's room very, very carefully and had many discussions about when and where and how it should hit her. And I think we started out with just, you know, whispers and then some words and then a flash of a face. And now these metaphors as he's banging on the door, he's coming in. And it was your idea to show the full episode, to have Lionel, not just the little introductions of him, but have him full force in the episode as a manifestation of Claire's self-doubt for not only the PTSD that she's suffering, but also that the PTSD sort of connects to this current trauma. Because it's not like, and that's what the whole episode is about. I can't compartmentalize anymore. The PTSD, the trauma I went through, now the trauma I'm suffering, now they're kind of bleeding into each other. And the doubts that she has are coming through the voice of Lionel, who is saying, you know, you're a murderer, you know? So that was another amazing idea. And that was your idea to insert this to this episode. That's something
Thank
that
you.
Was done.
I guess I'll take the credit or the blame, but it's no, I think it's something that, you know, I felt quite strongly that, you know, people can really hopefully relate to the fact that sometimes you do have an inner voice that kind of talks to you. And what was interesting about it for me, at least, is that he didn't have to speak in a Lionel kind of 18th century fashion, because he is speaking Claire's thoughts. It was something that gave us that flexibility to really kind of, you know, change up his use of language a little bit and kind of really sort of get into her psyche. And so, you know, whatever he's saying is something you can imagine possibly Claire saying in her own voice.
Yeah, that's a very interesting distinction, because we always are so careful with our characters to keep them in that 18th century dialect. And here, if, you know, it's something people might not even notice, because it's such a subconscious thing that, mm-hmm. hey, actually, yeah, he's talking with some modern words because it's actually Claire's voice. And I know that, you know, during the writing and the rewriting of the script, that was one thing you really had to keep an eye on when you looked back at what you'd written, is like, make sure that whatever he's saying is actually something that could come from Claire's head, that it mm-hmm. wasn't something that Lionel could say
exactly
from himself to Claire, because that is a fine line. And mm-hmm. that was challenging to keep it in that voice and make sure it's something that can easily slip into, oh, you know, Lionel, because he's such a great villain, and yes. he taunts her, you know, before, when he was alive, he taunted her so well that, you know, I think a couple of those slipped in. And I remember you saying like, oh, I've got to change this, because it's gotta be Claire. Mm-hmm, and it was mm-hmm. just a great device to use to show what Claire's going through.
And then I think, you know, Mrs. Berg here in this scene is kind of reinforcing, you know, the things that Claire is thinking about herself by, you know, kind of letting the Frasers know what people on the ridge are thinking, and kind of thinking here about, you know, how are they going to respond? What are they going to do? How are they going to tackle this problem together?
Right. I mean, back when, you know, there was only the accusation from Jamie, and Claire said, no one will believe it. And Jamie said, everyone will believe it. Now this crisis has gotten even worse, and, you know, a life has been lost, and it certainly looks very suspicious for Claire. In fact, I had several texts after the episode last week from friends, and that were like, we're very worried about Claire. And then I texted back, you should be. I even had a good friend, I was a longtime Outlander fan, who's another showrunner, who said that she was scared to watch your episode. I said, what do you think of the episode? She said, I haven't watched it. I'm too scared to watch it. I'm too scared for Claire. So
I mean, I understand why, but, you know, I think, yeah, you know, it's kind of getting to that dark place in order to find the light again. And
absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think Jamie here is kind of king of the castle, and he's, you know, defending his wife, and he's sort of doing everything he can to support her, because he really sort of, you know, knows that she's suffering. But I think he's trying to grapple with how best to kind of help her through this difficult time. And he's obviously trying to keep these gossiping ridge dwellers.
Well, away. And this, the settlers that came with Tom Christie, the fisher folk, we've made a point to say to the audience that they're superstitious lot of people who believe in a lot of superstitions. I mean, there's already a lot of superstitions among the Highlanders and the Scottish people, but the fisher folk, I guess, we did a lot of research, and they have a particular brand of that. And so it's the worst thing for Claire. They already suspect that she's a witch because of Granny Wilson, who sat up at her funeral. So this is like, you know, terrible, terrible news for Claire.
Mm-hmm. Lionel again.
Yeah, there's Lionel. And another interesting thing with these Lionel and what he's saying to her is we talk a lot, I know Matt and I always talk a lot about how much the script can be rewritten in post-production, because once we see it, we want to switch things around. And if you think about like the Never My Love episode, which Matt and I wrote in flat and with the flashes to the future, mm-hmm. or the dreams, not flashes to the future, the dreamscapes, which were taking place in the future. We wrote it linearly, but when we edited it, we mixed it up and we didn't have it be linear. We just put the flashes where they best fit. And there was a little bit of that going on in this episode because you had these pops of Lionel in different places and you had him saying different things in different places. And then once we saw the episode, there was some switching around done where, you know, you kind of scrambled it up and put it where it best went. So not every piece of Lionel or what he's saying is in the exact place it was in the script. If people want to look at the annotated script, they'll see some of the razzle dazzle that we do in editing where we can see it. Once you see it, sometimes it can change your mind about where things need to go.
I love this moment with Lizzie, where Brianna's pushing those leaves out of her hair.
Yeah, we're creating a little bit of a mystery about what's happening with Lizzie, what's going on. Later, we're going to find out that there is indeed something very interesting going on with Lizzie, our quiet little sweet Lizzie. She's having a bit of a secret romance.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Lizzie story, which kind of was, it's kind of what we call from the book, a standalone story. It's not really tied to a certain time. It could fit into to theoretically any episode. And so mm-hmm. I think it was in about three or four different episodes before it was mm-hmm. in this one. We had it earlier, then we moved it. And for various reasons, it would fall out. Like sometimes it just wouldn't fit in someone else's episode or their episode was too long. Probably one of mine, because mine are always super long, but it kept moving. And then finally it landed in yours. And I know that we had a lot of discussion of, would it be hard to put such a lighthearted sort of more humorous story mm-hmm. that was full of kind of more hope and love and all into this really tragic episode. And I know that you had reservations. We all did kind of like, is this going to fit or is it going to be too jarring to juxtapose these two stories? But from what I've read in some of the reviews and some of the Twitter, a lot of people are praising it and saying, thank God that we had this Lizzie story because they just couldn't take it. They couldn't take the darkness and the sadness of the other episode. And then it was nice to balance it. So I think it ended up being successful in that way because we were a little concerned about it, but it was the right decision.
Definitely. And
I think it goes well here.
I think, yes, it is, you know, it was a difficult decision to make, but I think the juxtaposition of the sort of, you know, Lizzie's joy at the prospect of having a baby versus, you know, the tragedy of Malva. And also, you know, I think it maybe added a little bit to the sense of danger in the sense of, you know, there's clearly a killer on the loose. You know, why did he go after Malva? Is it because she's an unwed mother? Or with child, just like Lizzie, you know, if that were to be found out, you know, we don't know who this killer is. So.
Right. In fact, I believe that in a previous version of the script, you had actually written a piece where it opened with Lizzie running through the woods and being chased. Mm-hmm. I just remembered that. And I think we even filmed that and she's being chased by unknown people are chasing her, and it was meant to sort of, you know, throw the audience off, and you think there's danger and you think maybe the killer is after her, and then it's revealed that it was the Beardsley boys and they were just frolicking in the playing chase in the woods. But I believe that ended up, it's something that ended up being cut because of the power of putting that Malva in church confession scene at the top of the episode. But that was one way the script changed a little after we saw the initial cuts of the episode.
Yeah. And obviously it turns into a little bit of a murder mystery here where they're trying to work out at the dinner table who the suspects are.
Yeah. The Perry Mason.
Little mention of Perry Mason. That's exactly what I was going to say. Little nod to the book chapter there. And obviously Ian can be brought into this. Yeah, he can be brought into the conversation because obviously he's knows their secret.
Yeah, and here we get the information about the Sin Eater. Yeah, again, this is as far as we go in the detective work, because we really just didn't want to do, it's not a CSI Fraser's Ridge. it really is, again, the emotions affecting everyone. And we know that it's affected young Ian, because he did have a little fling with Malva, and thinks that baby might have been his, which is weighing mm-hmm. on him.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Yeah,
but it
the
was
means,
a
the motive.
The means, the motive, and of course Claire yeah. hears this and she's like, I had all three of those, and she's very worried that she'll come under suspicion for this.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, Jamie doesn't doubt her for a second, but I think what Claire says here, a lot of people can relate to, in the sense of did I leave my hair straighteners on the bed? Did I leave my oven on? And you know that you haven't, but it's that feeling of kind of when you rush to go on holiday and you think, oh my God, did I lock the front door? And it's going to haunt you for the rest of the, holiday, unless you take a little photo of it. These days you can on your mobile phone. But
yeah,
I think that's what Claire's dealing with here, that she sort of knows deep down that she didn't do it, but there is that kind of element of doubt that mentioned also.
Well,
earlier,
that's
Tony.
Yeah. She in her head, she was angry at Malva. She reached out to her and tried to get her to tell the truth and make amends and give her an out, and Malva didn't take it. And so Claire ended up being very mad and basically saying, stay away from my family. And then Claire did, even if it, was in her mind or in person, threaten her. And if in your mind you're threatening someone and thinking, oh, I'll kill you, and then it happens, it's almost like you would almost think, if you didn't do it, did you will it? Somehow did you will it into being?
Mm-hmm,
did you,
mm-hmm.
Because you thought that. Imagine how, if you were angry at someone, and let's hope that none of us ever think in our heads, I would, wish death upon someone. But if you did, and then it happened, you would be thinking, oh, I shouldn't have thought that, or did that somehow, manifest in the wrong way. Because Claire really did care for Malva a lot. She just felt betrayed by her, but really loved her. And she's wrestling with all of this right now. And here's the episode where it comes to a head,
But she's certainly being haunted by her demons. And I love this, little clip here of Claire in the dark and she can't sleep. And, you've got Lionel there in the corner.
Yeah.
Won't leave her in peace.
Poor Lionel. He's the nicest guy, Ned. In person, he's a very nice guy, but he is a fantastic villain. But I feel bad almost, because he's so sweet, but he was, we were really happy that he was, he was very excited to come back, because he thought his role was done, obviously, because Marsley get away with him. Oh, I love this too. I love,
again, is, you know, this, Claire's...
is this book some voiceover from the book?
No, it isn't. It's book inspired, but it's not from the book. But it is Claire sort of, grappling with her identity. Who is she now? I think sometimes after something, tragic that happens in your life, or something traumatic, I think it does cause you to kind of question your identity a little bit. And Claire has had so many different monikers and different, identities over the years, a lot like Jamie in a way. That's something that they share. And I think, this moment in front of the mirrors, that's her kind of,
it's one of my favorite lines.
She believes she is.
Yeah, when Lionel says murderous suits best, that's one of my favorite lines.
And now Ian's come to bring them even more scandalous news. And I do think, obviously this is slightly different from the book, because we don't have Lizzie's father with us. But I think, you know, Ian is very much speaking from a place of care for Lizzie and for his aunt and uncle, because he does want to know, because I think, you know, he's put together in his head, well, if there's a murderer going around, you know, killing these young women, that perhaps Lizzie could be in danger as well.
Yeah.
Both of them at once, a very big scandal.
The very big scandal.
And this is, you know, this dialogue is in fact from the book, but as I say, it's just been transposed into Ian's mouth instead of Lizzie's dad.
Right. In the book, Joseph Weems, who's Lizzie's father, eventually comes over from Scotland to stay with them at Fraser's Ridge. And so they have a whole closeness and friendship there. And we weren't able to include that character. We wish we could. The audience knows how much we're trying to fit in from those massive books. So we weren't able to get Lizzie's father, but so yes, we often have to put some character's story in another character's scenes to compensate for that.
Here's Roger writing his sermon. And again, this moment is directly very heavily inspired from a book moment where they talk about some of the fisher folk, you know, thinking that murdered people turn into ghosts, and about, you know, souls with unfinished business and all that sort of thing. So really loved the idea that, you know, people have been talking about Claire behind her back. It adds to that whole sense of, you know, you want to stay focused on our characters, but through them, you're learning how other people are responding to the family. And so I think the fisher folk have been telling Jemmy all sorts of terrible things.
Right. Oh, this is... This is such a wonderful scene and such a great moment for Lizzie, for Caitlin, who we all love very much. And we've been, I think, looking forward to this speech since the beginning of the season. We were like, oh, somewhere in this season, she's going to get, you know, some cool stuff to do. And we knew that she would just knock this out of the park, you know, this big speech that... about why she, I mean, they're a 18th century thruple, I guess. and you know, I mean, bigamy is not really a laughing matter or anything. I mean, I think it's obviously frowned upon in many circles. it's not the, you know, the norm, but what we're trying to show is, you know, in her mind, you know, she's not looking at it as something lascivious. You know, she's such a sweet, innocent, gentle soul that in her mind, she really, she does love both of these people, and she loves their soul. She sees them as one soul in two bodies, or whatever that speech she gives. She's genuine in her love for them. And I know that we had a lot of discussions too about making sure that making it clear that she's not been taken advantage of by these guys, because the Beardsleys are good guys, and that this was something that she, you know, that she was not taken advantage of by them. That was, you could talk a little bit about why it was important that this wasn't something that, you know, went in that direction.
Yeah, that, you know, as you say, Tony, her love is very sort of pure, and she's very pure-minded, and that's one of the beautiful things about this character, is that she's so optimistic, so filled with joy, and she's, you know, just, you know, she thinks that this baby, you know, for her it's a miracle, and that is, as I say, you know, contrasted with poor Malva's situation, it does sort of bring home just how, you know, filled with wonder Lizzie really is. And, you know, I think that's a really interesting contrast.
Yeah. And Claire is a little bit always in sort of this between a rock and a hard place, because she is a modern woman in the 18th century who, if this was her daughter in the 1960s, you know, the the era of love, you know, the she would be saying, you know, love who you want, do your thing, you know, be careful. She'd be giving this sort of motherly advice that's not quite as judgmental as, but she's in the 18th century. So what she's got to say, look, I'm glad you're in love. And I applaud, you know, people who are happy and have romance, but in this century, would be a pretty big, huge, not only a huge scandal, but it could put her in danger. So Claire has to walk that line of being, you know, cautioning her, but it's sort of going against what Claire's own beliefs are, which is that, you know, hey, you know, everyone should do their own thing. And if that makes you happy and everyone's, you know, consenting, then that's cool with her, you know?
Yeah. Although I'm sure it would be pretty scandalous in the 60s too.
Well, yes, full-on bigamy probably cases. Would be. but there were just, I just mean that there was a lot of experimentation going on mm-hmm. in that era. And yeah. there was a lot of wild things happening with young people during that time. It was a particularly, you know, free love and all that was kind of the thing of the day, even more than it is now in some ways. And so, but Claire still, yes, she would still be a little, if it was her daughter, I think she'd still be like, but if it was Brianna, she might've had a few things to say. Yeah.
Roger is confronting Archbug, which is something that I thought was quite a fun moment, and it sort of leads into this Jamie and Roger conversation.
Yeah, you know, this episode was directed by Jamie Payne, who also directed last year's finale, Never My Love, and did a terrific job there. And we wanted him back for this season. And I think he did a fantastic job on this episode, because this episode is a quiet episode. It's a fantastic episode, but on paper, it is a quiet, very much a character piece. And it's challenging to direct because it is almost like a play. You know, it really is about this. There's a lot of two people scenes, and it really is about, there's not a lot of action sequences. There's not big party scenes, and you know, there's no hog roast. You know, every Outlander episode sometimes has a celebration or a big group scene, whether it's a fight mm-hmm. or a party. And this episode is a very quiet, focused on a lot of you know, two character conversations. So I think the stylistic elements that he added really, you needed a talented director who could put some visually interesting things in there, since it is on television okay. and it's not a play. But I love that it reads like a play, and I love that it depends so much on the words and the performances of the actors, who were all mm-hmm. just all bringing their A game. Well, they do in every episode, but in this episode, I think they went above and beyond. I mean, all of them are just
mm-hmm. and obviously, you know, still working within the COVID restrictions as well, which is another factor. And obviously you would want these scenes to be focused emotionally in the way that you just described in any case, but as you say, I think having a fantastic director like Jamie Payne really does help, and his kind of you know, vision and his visual language is something that I really love. And I was so delighted when I did see it, you know, brought to life. And you know, the lighting and you know, the DOP is just really beautiful. If you notice a lot of the Claire shots, she'll have light behind her, and she's almost sort of angelic in a way in a lot of these scenes. Mm-hmm. And I think this is nice because Roger and Jamie here, for the first time, you're starting to see that they do have a relationship that's kind of, you know, it's becoming a lot more positive, and you can really see that they do truly care about each other. And the fact here that he's confiding in Jamie about something before speaking to Brianna is, I think, kind of a milestone for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Their relationship has come a long way. I think Jamie is a growing respect for him.
She's She Has Eyes Too, which is a lovely book line that I definitely wanted to include there.
And the vegetarian line is hilarious. I saw a lot on Twitter. People were like, oh, I love Jamie's vegetarian line. Just the way he said that one word, vegetarians.
That it would be such an alien concept, I think, to anybody, from the past.
Yeah.
And now, Claire's sort of suffering. And you'll notice, talking about Jamie Payne's visual language, sometimes Lionel's there, sometimes you don't see him, sometimes his mouth moves, sometimes it doesn't. And it's just to add that sort of, I think, that kind of feeling of, a surreal, it's not like a horror movie in the sense that you don't want it like some big old ghost that's,
right,
too kind of comedic in a sense, but it really is that kind of psychological horror that she's experiencing.
And it was a deliberate decision that I think to have her not speak back to him until, I think that was the first time in this scene that she speaks back and says, stop it.
Exactly.
Because before he was just in her head. Now she's talking to him. And that was an awesome shot too, how he's talking to her. And when she comes over the bench, there he is already sitting mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And he's slightly out of focus.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a ghost. People kept sort of referring to him as ghost. He's not a ghost. He's just a specter. It's a little different.
And here, it's sort of culminating in all of these different voices from across, various seasons of things that have really pierced Claire's soul, words that have stuck with her. And I think you always have moments in life where maybe somebody says something to you quite off the cuff sometimes, or sometimes very deliberate, and for some reason those words just stay with you and they really just don't get them. And I think that's
this was an idea I believe of Matt Roberts that since we were exploring Lionel, let's have the walls breaking down to where other traumas are bleeding in, and it takes and it is exemplified by her hearing Blackjack, Galus, all the people that have tormented her or that she's had run-ins with over these years. It's like Lionel has opened this door and now they're all crashing back in on her, which, she'll talk about obviously in the big scene where she says, I can't compartmentalize anymore.
And here she's talking about the court of public opinion. And I think, she's got two battles going on. She's got a battle with herself, and she's got the battle with the people that are suspicious of her and, out in the world in public, where she's having to stand up and face trial in a way.
What made you want to explore this part of the story for this season?
Well, it's funny actually, because, obviously we're here kind of talking a little bit about behind the scenes and things like that. And for me, Malva's funeral isn't sort of fully described in the book. And that was one kind of little delicious moment for me of kind of really being able to dig into that trauma and the tragedy and the darkness, and kind of wonder what that would look like. And again, that's why I wanted to do the confession, Malva's confession up front, because I think just, me, Tony, I'm very kind of drawn to the sort of really psychological trauma elements and that sort of kind of darkness. I love the religious element. I love Tom Christie. I loved being able to show Roger giving a sermon. The notion of the little baby passed away here, that really tugged at my heartstrings. So I think, and again, I actually felt very, very fortunate to be able to kind of draw really heavily, on that book material with Lizzie as well. So you've got that little bit that's kind of, very much book inspired, but not explicitly there. And then you've got the bit that really is explicitly there. And that for me was very, very appealing. And even just, moments like in the church here, this particular moment isn't in the book, but it's just, I think it really does kind of help you understand where everybody's mind is and how they regard Jamie and how he's being sort of not cast out, but he is he's having issues with the settlers here, and they don't want him to be a pallbearer
Yeah, that's a theme of this season is, you know, the ridge, what happens when your home turns against you.
Mm-hmm.
And we've always seen Jamie as such an amazing leader and a revered figure, you know, and respected by the community. But here, you know, it's mainly his wife and his love for Claire that, you know, he stands by her no matter what, his love for her, but she costs him a lot because it puts him in these positions, you know, that there's things they can't explain to people about how she is. And she's often misunderstood and he has to constantly caution her, don't do this or that because people will misunderstand. And mm-hmm. he's not going to let that stand in the way of their love, but here, they've been through a witch trial once, you know, already her. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, it's not like that was the only time, it's never going to happen again. It's, you know, it's bound to rear its head again. And it has in this story several seasons later.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all love the book so much and we take every bit of gold we can from the book and yeah. there's lots of it to mine. But I think as writers too, it's not that we want to just insert our own stuff in there. It's that we're inspired by the book. We read the book and just like any other reader, our imaginations leap into all the crevices that maybe she didn't have time to explore, but she mentions or alludes to. And so mm-hmm. when we read, we want to fill those gaps. So whenever we put our own scenes in and we do that, I think that's our favorite episodes when we can do a blend of the great stuff that's in the book and then a few things that we can fill in
definitely.
Being inspired by the book, you know, and exploring the characters even more and maybe giving the audience things that they didn't get from the books. So that it's almost an expansion of the books. And
it is a kind of a literary work of art that, you know, to me, it's almost like you have this palette of colors that you're given and you take your paintbrush and you pick it up and you try and kind of, you know, bring it to life in a visual way, in a way that kind of reflects something that maybe you're imagining. But, you know, as you say, Tony, for me, you know, my first point of call is always the book. And even if it's something that seems off book, it's always been inspired by something in the book. For example,
yes.
you know, I wrote the episode 508 with Roger, you know, the silent movie. And that actually for me was inspired by a description in the book where Diana had very beautifully talked about Roger's body being covered in all these different bruises and they were blooming on his arms and you know, he had all these different colored bruises. And I thought, wow, that's making me think about, you know, black and white and color and, you know, the absence of color because that's what's missing from his life. So, you know, in suffering, he's experiencing color, but I wonder if you take that and flip it around and, you know, stuff like that, I think is really sort of can be inspirational to look at it as a literary artwork and then create further, you know, hopefully artistic, you know, things.
And the metaphor in that episode, you took the metaphor of Roger losing his voice from the hanging mm-hmm. and use the silent movie to show that. And that, you know, that too was a way of taking something in the book and just making it a visual. Oh, it's funny. Just made me think of last year. I wrote 507 and you wrote 508. And this year I wrote 606 and you wrote 607. So, because I think there's two great kind of episodes to write. Maybe this is terrible to say. I don't know if I can say the S word, but it's like when the it's the mm-hmm. fan.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the aftermath and the fallout. And sometimes I choose the episode where, you know, the shit is hitting the fan because mm-hmm. that's an exciting episode. But then you want to write the fallout too, because sometimes to me, the fallout is even more exciting than what happens when things go wrong. It's what the fallout is. And I'm drawn to those episodes. And I think in this case, this is the episode of the fallout, you know, and I could have written this one too. This is one I would be very drawn to as what happens after this, all these awful events, exploring the how it lands on all these people and the ripples that it causes.
Exactly.
Yeah, I just like those quieter episodes where you can explore that and you have the room to do that, as opposed to the ones where you have to make a lot of action happen, because that action eats up a lot of time. And on the page, the action is very short, like Atlanta Burns, you know? So if you get the Atlanta Burns episode, you might not have as much room for the quieter scenes that are my favorites and I think your favorites, but other people love that. They want the Atlanta Burns, and you need that too. You need the action, which I think we'll see a bit of that possibly next week, to tease a little. I think there's a lot of action, but also a lot of great quiet character moments coming up next week, which is the fallout from this. So certainly 606 started the ripple.
You know, the challenge and the beauty of adaptation of a novel is obviously because, you know, the characters can express their thoughts, but, you know, how do you do that in a visual medium? Obviously there's subtext and dialogue, but, you know, it's interesting to find ways. And obviously that's, you know, what Lionel is doing here is, you know, to really, really kind of dig deep into Claire's trauma. And I love that about, you know, the gift of being able to adapt books like this is that it allows you to kind of explore and mine that emotion, because it is all there. It's just, how do you bring it to screen? And, you know, there's a quote, I forget who it was who said it, but, you know, people say that adaptation is arrogance in a sense. And what that means, I suppose, is that, you know, by adapting something, you're inherently implying that you're bringing something new or different to it. So it's not so much maybe for me that it's arrogance. I certainly don't approach it that way. But, you know, what I'm saying, I suppose, is that it does imply that you're bringing a different perspective on something that already exists. And if it was, you know, two things alike, then there's no point in doing it, because you're trying to bring something additional to the experience of that other piece of artwork.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's really nice. I like that.
And here, Brianna and Roger kind of having their little heart to heart. And I think they're just, you know, at the beginning of exploring their journey together. And, you know, Brie is here hinting at the life that she used to have. I think that, you know, there's lots of new things happening for everybody. They're all beginning new paths in a sense.
Yeah, they're both kind of trying to find their place in the world since they've decided to stay.
And Claire's having a cup of tea, which is, you know, it truly is, I would say, you know, speaking as a British person, something that does, for us at least, cure every, you know, ill in the world.
It's
you begin true. Something, you finish something, you got to go and have a nice cup of tea. And I think that the point here is that, you know, Jamie knows that that's not what she's doing. He's obviously in tune with her enough to know that there's something wrong, but he doesn't want to trample on her coping process because, you know, she's trying her best.
When you suspect that things are going on with someone, you know, you have to pick your moment if you're going to, you know, confront them or talk to them about it, because they have to be in a space maybe where they can hear you. So he's gathering his suspicions. He knows her well enough to know her, something's wrong. And then later, of course, we see him finally, you know, have the big talk with her about it. And here's where we finally get an answer. And this is again where there's a synchronicity between our two episodes, because Claire heard when she was doing the ether, when Malva was coming towards the house toward in the end of the episode, she heard this pounding on the door, and she thought it was Malva trying to get in. And then that's what made her think that when she passed out, Malva did get in and threaten her. And that's when Claire threatened her. And that was the genesis of the whole dream that she had about Malva. And here she gets the answer. So it finally puts her self-doubt to rest, because she learns that it was Lizzie knocking on the door. And now, in a way, she thinks she's free. And I know we talked about this in the writer's room, like, Claire gets this moment of, oh, it wasn't me. I didn't cause this. I didn't do this to Malva. And she thinks maybe in some small way that that's going to get rid of Lionel and get rid of this haunting specter that's been after her. But it doesn't quite work. In fact, she goes and puts the ether away, like
she does,
like I'm going to make some steps towards, and she turns around and there he is. And I love that the way Jamie has visualized all this, Jamie, the director, that now he's literally facing her in her face. He's not just hovering mm-hmm. over her shoulder. He's not sitting next to her on the bench. She turns and he's right in her face. And he's like, you're not getting rid of me that easy. So the solace that she got from learning that it wasn't Mob banging on the door and that she never had this real conversation with Mob, it was all in her head, has not given her any peace. And that's kind of what cracks her open now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's probably, you know, obviously everybody deals with trauma in different ways. But I do think that it's something that it doesn't just go away overnight. And there are not necessarily magic words that you can say. Obviously, if you have an undying love in the way that Jamie and Claire do, then you have the tools that you need available to you to have that support. But, you know, I think as a coping mechanism, a lot of people talk about, oh, you know, does this make Claire weak? But for me, it makes her strong because she is trying to carry that burden for everybody on the ridge. She doesn't want to display weakness because that's who she is. So she's not displaying weakness. She's literally hiding and, you know, finding a way to self-medicate, you know, as doctors occasionally do. And, you know, she's, I think, finding a way to keep calm and carry on is how I see this.
And this particular scene, I know that we talked a lot, and the decision to have Lionel in the room with Jamie mm-hmm. and Claire means that just shows how strong her visions are, because normally Jamie is her solace. He is her protector. Mm-hmm. And then this specter, this Lionel it doesn't go away when someone else walks in the room. And Jamie, of all people, you would think that would chase him out of the room and out of her head, but it doesn't. So I think that's what makes her, it's an important part of what makes her decide to talk to him now and crack open and really tell him everything that's been going on and open up, because she's really backed against the wall here, knowing that Lionel was in the room. He's coming between them, and this couple takes care of to let nothing come between them.
Mm-hmm. Now, I love the look that actually Katrina gives just prior to this, where they're talking now, where she kind of glances in as though she does think that Lionel's in the room, and she's sort of saying, no, don't go in there, to Jamie, because she thinks in a way that he's going to find him in there, but obviously he's not real, but he's very real to her, and that's the important thing.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, being able to acknowledge that she's got darkness in her is something that does make her very strong.
Well, this is a bit of a callback to when Jamie was going through his trauma, and he mm-hmm. had this PTSD and from his assault, and he was going through his own nightmares and his own coping mechanisms. It was when Claire said, you know, he couldn't come to her, and he gives her that great speech about the blade of grass and hiding. Well, the ether has been her way of hiding, feeling naked and hiding under a blade of grass. The ether is her blade of grass. And he's using on her the same thing that she used on him to pull him out of that. When she said, find me in the dark, you know, mm-hmm. find me in the dark. It's only me. And if you just close your eyes and we're in the dark, just trust that I'm here and let me help you through this and let me carry this with you. And here is he turning it and saying the same comfort to her, which is, let me in, because if, as long as you're in that dark room by yourself, mm-hmm. I can't get to you. I can't help you. And using the ether, you are putting a wall up and you're in the dark by yourself, and I can't get to you to share this burden with you. Mm-hmm. So let me into the dark, and the two of us can tackle anything together. And so I like the synchronicity between those two, you know, that was way back in one of the early episodes, but their relationship always sort of comes full circle, where he does this for her, then she does it for him later, or she mm-hmm. does something for him and he does it for her later. They mm-hmm. take turns, you know, which is what good couples do, take turns propping each other up when they need each other.
Exactly. That I would say, you know, that sort of mentally they haven't been really very separated at all, you know, to this extent for a long time. And so now this is them, you know, coming back together and really, as you say, you know, she's allowing him to join her in her distress and in her difficulty.
Yeah. And we wanted to make sure that there was no easy answers, that it wasn't like, oh, we had a big talk, or you stop doing ether and everything's fine now. We wanted mm-hmm. to be clear that it's a process, that it's not going to go away with any magic wand, but that they can work through this together.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And also that the burden that she feels of that coming here has cost them all this pain. She's cost Jamie pain, and she's cost Brianna and Roger. Everyone has suffered because of her decision to come and be with Jamie. So she's feeling the weight of all that. But we always knew that the end of this speech, and I know this was this big, long scene, and we both love writing these big, long, you know, 8-10 page scenes, which you can't really do on other shows. But I think when we're writing them, we always know what the beginning and the end is, and we fill in the middle. And I think you always knew that the end was going to be, I'd do it all over again. Here's yeah. all my doubts. Here's all of my, you know, the burden I'm carrying. Here's all my fears. But in the end, if what I say is, I'd still choose you, I'd still do it all over again for you. I think that's the, you know, mm-hmm. the essence of what their love story is both of them, even given all they've been through, would choose each other
yeah.
all over.
Yeah.
And I love how he comes in here for the Jamie Claire theme. It's,
mm-hmm. you know. For every kind of moment of sorrow that she lists, he gives her something positive back. And, you know, I really got attached to the notion that, you know, without Claire being there, their world does crumble, you know, into dust, because she is what's kind of binding them all together, and she's the, you know, the sort of the hook that kind of
right.
the pinnacle and the web that spreads from her and brings all these people to this time. And we do exactly. have some levity now a little bit with the, you know, those cheeky little Beardsley boys and
Lizzie is being very cheeky here now, because she is very, very clever.
Mm-hmm.
She's playing one side against the other there. I love that Roger's just standing there in his nightgown or whatever. Mm-hmm.
That's from a book moment that I definitely wanted to capture. There's this sort of yeah. iconic line that he says about not wanting to conduct his first wedding bare ass, and I could not leave that out. So
right. I'm not gonna do the wedding bare assed or something, right? He
says. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. And it's nice because, you know, in the end, putting this story here allowed that kind of thread of the Brianna and Roger Minister thing to be sort of, you know, he's got something here he can actually do. He can, you know, conduct this hand fasting, so to speak, and, you know, before they go off to Edenton. Oh, and now
they have to figure out. It out. They get outed.
I love Sam's expression here, where he looks like a really disappointed father in a moment where he gives Claire this look, and sort of you can see that he's disappointed with them, and you know, he's being a true 18th century man.
He's had a lot of humorous moments this season, along with the serious ones, Sam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here's his disappointment. So he's got his hands on his hips, disappointed dad. And he's also sad to see Roger and Brianna go, I think. But
Right.
I liked being able to include this little bit about monogamy here. You know, which is, you know, sort of interesting coming from Claire as well. Obviously, she's completely faithful to Jamie, but she was married, you know, twice too, but technically not.
Well, and technically, so was he, wasn't he? He was married to the woman who shall remain unnamed that the audience has such an antipathy for.
Throwing stones at glass houses. That was teasing.
That's right. No. They both didn't know the other one was married and the other one was 200 years away. So it doesn't count. And here comes, well, of course, we remember the ending of, the last scene with the Browns where Richard Brown said, you did what you must to Lionel. And I understand that, but one day I'm going to do what I must. And here we get to see, he finally gets his moment to seek his revenge on Jamie and Claire for what they did. His brother, and he just loves it. He's loving it. This is Richard Brown in his all his glory. And I think
what's interesting about it too is, Claire has finally had this moment of realizing, okay, I definitely didn't kill Malvar. It wasn't me. And the irony is that here they come showing up to arrest her for that exact crime of which we know for sure that she didn't do it. So,
yeah. There's a big trouble. I need to text my friends and say, you got to keep watching because more trouble come. So I hope you guys will watch next week. I have no doubt that you will. It'll be the final episode of season 6. And it's a whopper. It's a great one. So everybody join us and we'll see you on next week's podcast. And I can't wait. So thank you for being with us. Thank you, Danny.
And thank you. Thank you. And I hope you're all enjoying the show and thank you for having me on this week.
All right. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.